Now, here's an interesting thing. Who are the nurses in hospitals? It's a minority women, and they get this job, and they're learning how to be mechanical, like Mexicans say, who haven't, who live out in the rural thing, agriculture. They come to the cities, they get these nurse jobs, and they're totally being the mechanical concentration camp thing, but it's new for them. It's the east going west and the west going east. The rural kids coming out, and it's a big deal to be in the mechanical city. So they're going mechanical, while the kids who grew up in the cities, they're going rural. They're going into the commune out in the country.
They're just people who are in one environment, and they want to put on another environment.
The other environment, that's right. That's mobility of our time. Tactility, which means everybody's in touch with everybody and in the same space, turns mobility, kinetic mobility, into an art form. And that's why we're a nomadic society. We're all running around trying to escape the tactile membrane that we're in right now. We're right in the tactile membrane. So kinetic space becomes rampant. Everybody's just moving, jumping from one scene to another. McLuhan would say, why go down to the office when you could do your work on the phone? Well, the phone is the membrane, and you escape from the membrane if you're visually biased. You've got to get moving. Got to get out in your car and traffic jam to have some privacy away from the membrane.
For me, one of the biggest contrasts between Berlin and Mexico City is the noise. In Mexico, there are no laws for noise. Everybody can have their music. And it's a real cacophony. Sometimes in the streets, there are people selling things on the street, and they have their music very loud. And besides him, it's another person, and they have another type of music very loud, or in a big plaza, there are many different types of people playing different types of music, and it's like people doesn't seem to mind. There is TV or music everywhere.
That's an acoustic society.
Yes, because as you say, many people is not literate, and they're coming from this acoustic space.
A literate professor went to India, and he told me when he came back, he was unbelievable, the cacophony in the Indian culture in the cities and towns. He just found it incredibly noisy. He understood acoustic space. He was a friend of McLuhan, so he understood that after coming back from India. Well, you get the same experience going to Mexico.
Yes, or in Turkey or in Morocco, or it's like you feel like there is a lot of stimuli coming to you, like all these colors, all these noises, all these people. It's like too much.
Especially if you've lived in Berlin and become visually conditioned.
Part of the problems, I think, also with very strict social differences between rich and poor has to do with this. Some are more literate and some are acoustic.
That's right. When you bring in industrial literate society, you have a separation of wealth. You start having classes. You have caste in an oral society, but class warfare comes in with literacy. And that's because, one's more literate than the other.
And you literally have classes.
Yeah, you have classes. And so since medieval people start to like the printing press, so it's a novelty to get literate, so you get aristocratic and literate, and the daughters, they learn their poetry and take over the arts, sort of. That's all new, and so it was great being literate. It was a new experience. So it separated the upper classes from the lower classes. So that's when electric media came in and put pop culture in everybody's home, and you see that acted out in Downton Abbey where the old aunt can't take anything that's pop culture. That is the dirty oral coming in to mess up the aristocrats, but the aristocrats have the idea that there's high art, and they've been celebrating that for 300 years, and they don't understand that they have to get dirty with the noise of jazz. So you see the snobbery, high art snobbery, say in 1920, comes from the fact it was a great thing to be visual and quiet and detached. That was a posture. And that's what New York City's for. You become a billionaire, so you got to go sit in boring operas. You start retrieving highbrow literate art. That's the status of New York City. You get the tickets to the opera and to the museum galas and this and that, and you redo Gutenberg culture because you're rich and you think you've got a lot of money, and money is visual space, so you have to support the museums and all the high culture. That's precious objects to support the value of money in a world generally where money is useless. I mean, you know, culturally, because people in the 50s, 60s are watching TV and there's all kinds of free experiences. But if you want to become wealthy and pretend you've got a visual space top position, you're wealthy, you're rich, you adopt the art forms of that visual space. You go to the opera.
A lot do. Then you say the electric environment created the T-shirt CEO or the T-shirt shorts CEO.
The digital environment did that, Silicon Valley. The digital was the extension of tactility, not a hidden ground. It just was blatant tactility. So you had to be tactile to be creative in that new technological environment.
That's how, with the electric environment, everything becomes art, and even like the package of soap or soup or everything can be as valuable as a painting.
Now, when you say electric, better to say digital, because you got a whole digital phase, 30 years or more of digital life. The electric is the analog. So if you want to sound a bit modern, you got to say digital, because it's a different dynamic. It is underneath it, electrical. But there's electric.
But, I'm talking of that period of
pop. Oh, okay, yeah. As long as you mean back then, yes.
Yes.
Electric, electronic, digital, like three phases.
Now there's more abstraction.
McLuhan said abstract art left out visual high definition, so it created involvement. You had to fill in. But other times, abstract art is the mechanical. Maybe the Pierre Mondrian, those grid-like abstract art, that is like the mechanical blueprint becoming art form because it's superseded by the electric environment. So mechanization takes command.
In many abstract art, the concept is more important than the object.
Yeah, the title. Well, that gets into Tom Wolfe, who's influenced by McLuhan, his book, The Painted Word, where the theory was more important than the painting.
Yes, and this is when one, for example, sees these paintings in modern art museums, like Black Square, this Russian Rothko,
Malevich.
It's just like a color graduation. I think the real enjoyment, the real aesthetical enjoyment, I've been in front of Rothko's, and it's more what you read about the painting than the actual painting. It's more
that's the best
the
way
concept
to say it.
That he's evoking that color.
I'm calling that the theory. The theory, you read about the theory.
Yeah, because you have those paintings that have like three strips of paint on them, like three colored bars that will sell for multi-million dollars.
Because of a theory. Look at it this way. In the tactile 20th century, you had the abstract visual blueprint, Mondrian, and then you also had the Jackson Pollock abstract get involved and fill in. So there's the visual abstract and then the oral abstract. The two of them were mixed in the painting, including the conceptual theory, but it's because it was tactile, which means it was the interplay of the three modalities, eye, ear, and concept. So modern art was neither eye, neither ear, but it was both because there was a tactile ground.
The most expensive contemporary German artist is not only the artist. They have a whole team doing the concepts and the theories and the marketing. It's like a corporation behind the artist. Once I saw the documentary, and he was doing some, like, very gestural
things. Richter? Is Richter like that?
Yes, like Richter and others. Yeah. He was just, like, doing huge paintings with a lot of gestures, like throwing things with color and all these impact and Zufall, it's like you don't know what's coming, aleatory.
Right.
And he would just do the work, and then all this team of people will say what he's expressing and what it's all about.
It's like Andy Warhol said, he moved into, in the 70s, he moved into business art. So you became a manager of an office as an art form. You'd be on the manager level, and so you'd have all your different underlings doing different parts of the environment. So it wasn't the object so much, it was the environment of you're in charge of a team or a structure. That was the art form. That was the role you were playing in the global theater.
I think that's also from the literary societies that the person consuming this type of art needs all these theories, all these concepts,
right,
to really enjoy the piece of art.
McLuhan used to say that the literate person who thinks they're so detached are the most manipulated because they fall in love with ideas and propaganda. They love theories, they love concepts like ideas. The French are very like that, and so they're easily manipulated because they fall for the concepts. In a tribal society, you can't propagandize on the level of theories and words. They're not interested. They don't have that abstract visual bias. Tom Wolfe should have written the painted word better. He should have pointed out a lot more of the McLuhan ground to what he was doing. He was just satirizing that the theory was more important than the painting. But if he really knew his friend McLuhan's work, he could have explained the way I'm talking about, figure ground of visual space and abstract space and all that stuff. He could have made it not such a flippant book.
And your statement there about you can't propagandize in a literate manner to tribal societies, another way of maybe saying that is you can't take a piece of the literate environment and inject that or bring that into an acoustic or tribal environment. You have to take that individual and put them inside the environment of literacy.
Literacy. And McLuhan said literacy took the longest environment to get hold as an environment. It took 200 or 300 years to have the Gutenberg press become part of society and embedded into the psychic dreams of people. And therefore, when you suddenly take third world cultures in the 20th century and make them become industrial, they do it differently. Well, they actually do it communistically or group mind. They put on literate industry with a group mind because they haven't had the 200 years of literate individualism. And then that leads to tribal warfare, and that's why Mandela couldn't do anything with his freed country after he got out of jail. There was too much of the tribal clan behavior fighting going on, doing modern industry, which is high-tech and literate, but they brought their group mind to it, and chaos happened.
What about this notion of being visually biased in literate society? Us, for example, with our technologies, keeping things clean and sort of hidden, but when you introduce the technology over to, say, like India, you have all of these wires and stuff just piled up in the streets, and it looks like a health
not
hazard.
Tidy.
It's almost like it's not tidy, but it's like they don't have the visual.
They don't see the wires.
Right.
We see the wires. What a mess.
They are not bothered from all these visual things. It's like too much color, too much noise, too much everything, and they seem not to be so affected by it.
It's a fish and water analogy. The fish doesn't realize that it's in water. You have to take it out.
Yeah, but a literate person goes there, it's just too much. On the recording last week, McLuhan's talking about gesture versus non-gesture, and he says, the backwards peoples like the French and Italians are more gestural.
That's when he was talking about language and how the children who, he called them dumbbells at one point, but he said the children who weren't visually biased used all their senses, were able to learn language a lot faster than a literate biased person.
Yeah, it's in Canada. To keep Quebec in the country and not separate, they made education be bilingual all across the country. So all of a sudden in the 70s, the kids had to learn French in English provinces. And he's saying the dumbbells, because he's a literate biased guy, the dumbbells were better at learning French than the highly advanced students. The nerdy, bright, literate, get high mark students couldn't learn the French. They weren't acoustic enough. They couldn't immerse in it. They were too detached, too abstracted. So, he's calling them dumbbells, and he's laughing as a rube almost. You know, he's a rube himself. McLuhan lets his hair down there, looks like a rube. Remember, he's from Manitoba. I think he meant that as satire. He knew he was being theatrical. When he said the primitive peoples like the French and Italians, he knew that would be heard someday, and that was a Manipian dig.
he also said the person is not brainy, he's just more specialized in his visual, in his sensory lifestyle issues and his eye.
And then you hear Ted Carpenter's speech, he says the brainy people are becoming more handicapped because it's a post-visual eyeball society, and the brainy people aren't able to take it. So they end up in the CIA or working for NASA in some isolated lab.
Even when he did these comments, he was never making a judgment or being moral about
this. He's talking
technically. He was just being like matter of fact. It's like this.
He said the French and Italians, if you had confronted him, he said, well, I'm talking technically. The barbarian is more oral versus the literate English. So, yes, the English think that the French and Italians are barbaric, and the French and Italians think the English are barbaric because there are different modalities there. So technically they are more primitive, more oral, because he said civilization is visual. So primitive is oral. So he could have covered his ass there if anybody cared. But you have to realize he puts out so many of his ideas in these talks and conversation. It's like reading his books. He's got as many ideas in his books as he does in speech or vice versa.
I read from all the books, and that doesn't bother me. I have the impression he wrote in a way that you can do that. Like you can go to a book and then to another book, and it doesn't matter.
You're saying it doesn't bother you to do what?
To be reading from all different books, different
same time.
Chapters.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think he did that very aware, like you could do that.
Here's how you prove it. He pointed out that the Torah, the Jewish literature, always had the punchline on every page. They'd write it so the punchline would be said on every page. So he's just pointing out the medium as a message and making that punchline be pretty well every page and in every book. It's like the same idea. And he used to say, all the great geniuses only had one idea, and they would spend their whole career, you know, tidying up the one idea, decorating it, but it was only one idea. He knew that's what he was doing himself. So, yeah, the same point is being made everywhere. So it doesn't matter which book you read to get the point.
Tony Schwartz had an interesting observation about McLuhan. He said something about the writing made him think, but listening to him actually allowed him to apply it.
But McLuhan made a snarky remark. He says, I get more out of your talking or something, you know, the eye versus the ear. And McLuhan says, well, that's normal. That's a normal response.
That's
what happens when you read books. You know, you have to you get it. You hear it. He's dismissing it. And then he responds by giving a totally different idea. There's a couple times where Tony would say something, I got this. And then Marshall would say the opposite and say that's what it was about. And Tony wouldn't notice it.
And during that clip where he said that, that's when they got the idea, said maybe we should take your books and make them audio.
And Marshall Mealy said, oh, I think that's an excellent idea, Tony. He was like me, man. He liked to get people to do the work for him. Yeah, he was going to get Tony to do all that album stuff. It's probably why he was hanging out with Tony. That was a way of getting himself translated into other media. When that was said, he jumped on that right away. He said, I think that's a tremendous idea. Yeah, I think this stuff should be translated into sound. Yes, that's right. Because he wanted to get his stuff as mixed and translated and in different media as much as possible.
And he can talk about anything. And it makes sense. I mean, it's not like technical, but because
it fits into a system. He's organized our sensory experience into order. The sight does this. The ear does that. The foot does this. The touch does this. And then he shows how the machines mime the senses. It's all perfectly organized. So it's formulaic.
There was something he said, I wanted to run it by Carolyn. There was something he's talked about, color, black and white and color, that black and white you pick up and movement from your periphery, and the color is picked up from the center of an eye. And I'm like, how the fuck did he know that?
Like Roxy could right now go pick up her Through the Vanishing Point, she has a copy of, and go back there to the back of the book and read A Note on Color, where he explains the center of the eye is movement, or the periphery is movement. Like he said, to register the movement is in the periphery. That's why people would watch tennis. As people start to move in the cars, They remember, they never move like that. So they're moving their cars. Yeah. They're activating their outer edges of their eyeball. So a sport has to come in to mime that activity. Tennis comes in, and you're using the corner of your eye going back and forth only because you've been driving a car.
It's
partly comic. Well, you got through the vantage point there. Go to the end where it has a little part, a note on color and tactility. Can you see it? The final page is in the last essay.
So the center or macula lutea of the eye is responsive to hue and variations in hue and texture. The periphery, on the other hand, is concerned with the darkness and lightness, and also with movement. Although the eye can eliminate any consideration of hue, for example, in scotopic or twilight vision, when the macula is involved, it is inevitable that the periphery be involved as well. In other words, the macula and periphery work in tandem. However, peripheral vision can exist by itself. While color vision is inclusive, black and white is partial. Black and white TV is automatically inclined toward movement, just as surely as color TV is inclined toward stasis and iconic values.
When color TV comes in by the mid-60s, everybody starts taking drugs and sitting there on drugs, stoned, listening to long guitar solos. McLuhan saw that, the effect of color TV on the middle of the eye, enhancing iconic stasis. So people, the hippie culture, just sitting there stoned listening to long guitar solos. That's an effect of color TV, he would say. Because the center of the eye got activated, the static part, the stasis part of the eye, not the movement edge, periphery. What's the next sentence?
The potential of any technology is always dissipated by its users. Involvement is in its predecessor. The iconic thrust of color TV will be buried under mountains of old pictorial space.
The iconic stasis of color TV will be buried under mountains of visual space. That means many books and literature and papers. Is that people writing reports, PhDs, reading a lot? Remember how Ted Carpenter said the underground will become literary? Yeah, it's just that the old space will become figure, mountains of pictorial visual space, and the ground will be iconic stasis, the hippie culture. People would say, well, McLuhan said the book is dead, or the book is obsolescent. Why are people reading more than ever? See, by obsolescence, he meant more and more of it. It just didn't affect society. What was really affecting society was the new iconic color TV affecting the macula in the middle of the eye. And so iconic art would be the psychedelic poster that comes in. There would be, in a literate society, mounds of visual space, more and more reading, more and more papers, more and more Xeroxing, to counter the alien iconic effect of the color TV on the center part of the eyeball.
So that would be the periphery becoming emphasized.
Yes,
or
the periphery being emphasized as a complementary action. You know, you would have a real iconic society coming in, and therefore there'd be lots of obsolete movement and papers and running around, avoiding the iconic effect of the new ground. He was always showing the natural ecology. This was the update of the poetic vision. Whatever the romantics saw in nature, or whatever previous poet movements, they would see symmetry or beauty or vision or order, if they're Western, in somewheres, in nature, in the ruins. He talks about the ruins in the 1600s, 1700s. Now he was showing the ecology in society, that when you brought in an iconic environment, you had mountains of visual space to balance it off. You see, it's a vaster global nature he's looking at. Media nature and the patterns of order that humans did unconsciously. Now, that's quite a beautiful vision.
Well, it's amazing because he starts with the Altamira caves.
Yes.
Acoustic space preliterate.
Yep.
And it's all, the whole roof of the cave, there is no perspective.
No visuality. It wasn't meant to be seen.
And we finished with the macula and the periphery.
We finished back in cave art. He called advertising the cave art, caveman art of suburbia. So we end up, we go full circle. So he's miming thinning his wake. He's showing the book going in a circle. He ends up back at the caveman in the 50s and 60s in the pop art and the art of basically advertising, cave art. Ads weren't meant to be noticed. They were supposed to be voodoo on people. Now, most people say, no, ads are supposed to be noticed. You have to notice it and register it, and then it fools you. It brainwashes you. McCoon says, no, there's no brainwashing going on in advertising. Advertising is just there demonstrating the artifacts of the culture as a hidden propaganda, making it normal to have these things, to have those environments.
That's really good.
That's good, isn't it?
Especially now when Google realizes what you're into and it starts giving you the things that you're searching for.
It's extended ESP. I mean, I go to YouTube. As soon as I go to YouTube, there's a bunch of Zappa fucking videos. They're all ready for Bob, but reserved up for Bob. I go, fuck you. I haven't listened to Zappa in 2 months.
They have this software, these algorithms, according to what you give into the Internet. They start, like, saying what you want to, what it's, you are supposed to be interested in and what you like. So that's how you get this... suggestions. For example, if I Google for something and you Google for something, our results are going to be different because of these big data algorithms.
Yeah, the big new book is Big Data, which Roxy, I guess, is reading or seeing a documentary on. That's the new thing. De Kirchhoff talked about it last summer. That's the book that tells everybody how much the Endormeme is monitoring everybody on a one-to-one basis. Aren't we saying that? The algorithm is their way of bringing Zappa to me.
They call it personalization, but it's actually a type of censorship. You don't really get any option but what they think you will like.
They said that in Wired magazine 20 years ago, and I noted that. And that became part of my definition of the Android meme. It's there to make itself invisible and give you what you want. So someday... you will only have news about yourself. So it makes you more and more into what I call the matrix tube, right? You get just lost in your little world. And that's the censorship that the young kids don't know. They don't know that it's all becoming geared to them. It's like spoiling them. It's nothing about their narcissistic world. And they aren't allowed to see other worlds. That's the bias of the Android meme today. It's making it all about you. Now, you'll see that in my lecture in Halifax on July 4th, 2001, I actually predict in my opening statement, the 911, I didn't know I meant that, but I talk about the old Western movies, you know, the town is having a party and the bad cowboys sneak in behind the party and blow up the bank and rob it. I said, today, the Americans are celebrating their independence, July 4th, I'm saying to these Canadians in Halifax. And I said, we're going to sneak in and reveal their situation and steal the best of their cultural capital through my lecture. So I used the metaphor stealing while a party's going on. Well, in 2001, there was a big internet, you know, digital party going on, and then the Al-Qaeda snuck in under that guise of the party, the cacophony, the digital cacophony.
Yes, but what I could add is like what you say, that under electric conditions, people lose their identity and we are quadrophrenic. Yeah. We don't really know who we are. And at the same time, we never had so much data about us.
McLuhan says we lose our identity in the 60s. That's under analog media. He then says 10 years later that the digital media will bring back a private identity. See, you got to know what McLuhan said later, and every commenter McLuhan doesn't know later McLuhan. He knew the situation had changed, and he wouldn't say in 1978 what he said in 1967. The virtual self was retrieved. A visual space, virtually, was retrieved, and a retrieval of private identity. And Bob Logan, one of his co-writers, went on writing books about it. Yay, computers are bringing back literacy and all its effects. I put him into the diasporic school of media culture. They're trying to celebrate visual values. Gutenberg values are being brought back, but it isn't really that. that's a virtual or a fake retrieval of private identity. So what you just said, Roxy, is what I mean. Everybody does have super private personalized identity dumped on them now.
And we become public domain.
That's Marxist. That's where you bring in Wyndham Lewis categories. We're part fascist. That's a retrieval of your virtual private self. You're a communist. That can either be the spiritual, non-physical, or you are public data. You know what I mean? You're shared. And then you add in the anarchist and the monarchist.
And there are companies that are even interested in your digital trash and the things
yes.
you don't like.
That's tetrad management. Everything is information. Everything can create patterns, so you don't have value judgments or hierarchy over what information is better than other information. All information is garbage to make patterns out of. Data trash. That's what I mean by tetrad management. Or then the Android meme does pentad management.
The Android meme is worshiping you in the sense it evokes that the rocks will cry out sort of message.
In movies, the viewer was the camera. But in TV, the viewer was the screen. So it's the TV star looking at you. And then the Android meme brought in the computerized digital stuff and refined the looking at you. And then started to, you know, custom tailor you to yourself.
Or I like your attempting to become you or like you.
Yes, yeah. They're serving the you that you want to be, and it'll help you define what you are, and then you can cheat and change your shape and your photographs. But it begins, it reverses. When the TV comes in, it's the totally opposite of movies. Movies projected you out on the screen, and you were the camera, flowing around, observing things as the camera. And you were looking at the screen like looking at a book page. TV made it that you were the screen, and TV was looking at you. Totally opposite to movies.
The light from the TV moving through you.
It's bombarding you. Joyce called the charge of the Light Brigade. Punning on the Crimean War, the charge of the Light Brigade. He changed it to the charge of the Light Barricade. And you'll hear McLuhan on the Eric McLuhan thing talk about the light attacking you.
The Marxist utopia, everything, everybody is that data. It makes everything and all equal.
That's why they think Marx is coming back. See, that's the communist part of the digital world. Everybody's in one big commune or kibbutz.
In the cloud.
So there are actually,
in the cloud,
there are
yeah.
actually, there are actually people that think Marxism is coming back?
Yes.
It's a big trend in the...
Yeah. In the left, they think their day is coming back. Now, see, there's something you don't immediately understand, but if you bring in the four bodies, then see what they're saying about what they think is happening, you can fit it into one of the bodies. And it's understandable why they think that.
You did the outline on the Tuesday show, so then that's the mystery body that they're interpreting as Marxism.
I say the astral body is communist, because everybody has the same non-physical or astral level, whatever you want to call it. But ion is something different. The astral body is astral projection at best. It is being an angel. It's still a literate kind of experience. But the mystery is totally chaotic. And the mystery landscape is, you know, the fact that we're pre-recorded, it's a bit different from the astral body. The astral body is traditional spirituality within linear space. The mystery landscape is just anamorphic chaos, not the hologram macro-micro structure. The literate Marxists are confusing the Marxist body, which is the chip body, or the communist astral body. They're mixing it up. They definitely wouldn't think it's non-physical, but it could be non-physical astral being prominent via ion's mystery landscape. And they are interpreting it as the literate Marxist body, which would be television. See, Marx is television. Everybody shares the same iconography. And you're also king of what you survey. But the anarchy is what you do in the chip body.
Yes, and I'm also thinking of just the Ionic sense of whatever you seek, you find, whatever you speak is. And
well, that would be the mystery bodies. You know, Wyndham Lewis's statement does not include the fifth body, I don't think. He's only part fascist, part communist, part Marxist, part anarchist, with some contradictory angles. You know, I got monarchism in my Marxism. I'm an anarchist with a healthy passion for order. I'm a communist and a fascist. The Ionic is not included by these guys. I actually have a section I did with Ion this morning about how there is the non-physical in Finnegan's Wake. It predicts Iondom like the Bible, but Joyce wasn't aware of it. The language did it, and non-physical put it in there somehow. The guy says if the chemical and the astral are part of first nature, then the TV does the chemical body, and the chip body is mirroring, paralleling the astral body. Because you can go anywhere if you can astral project. So you can go anywhere on your chip body. But when you watch TV, you kind of just sit there on the couch. Or that was the old way. And that's like having a physical body. You're stuck here. You're stuck in a body. Just like when you watch TV, you're stuck watching TV. Now, but Ion comes in and says, well, they've all merged. And that's true because people don't watch TV that way unless they have big screens. They still watch TV, but they have these huge screens. That's the only way to accept it, right? The TV has to become like a movie. Movie theater, the larger screens. This may be a trend. The college-educated people go for being active on the chip body. The poorer working classes, not so educated, literate, they go for the big TV screen.
But there may be a crossover now. I remember Ion talking about how easy Apple is or something, that maybe they can somehow engage the chip body now. It's not as difficult as it was like maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm talking about 10 years ago, because I remember on City Island, I'd walk around, and middle-class and lower-middle-class working people, they all had big TV screens. So what you have there, the illiterate, educated, management-level type of person would have the small iPod, the small BlackBerry, and they'd be mobile. They'd be going from one branch of the company, traveling around the world as part of their business life. Whereas the working class, they work in a factory, and they don't go anywhere, right? They're not flying around moving. They're static. So they become more tribal, and then they use the tribal medium. And so to expand their horizons, they can't move, so they move by having a bigger screen, which maybe affects the macula or the periphery. But they are static, so they have to expand within this. They have to have motion in the static position they're in. They're not mobile, so they have a big screen. That implies a bit of a movement from the little screen.
In Mexico, there are going to be elections, and the party in power is giving away digital TVs, the big ones, to people that maybe don't even have electricity, but everybody's getting their TV. I don't know if they sell them, but everybody gets their digital TV.
So they get a big TV, and they don't have electricity, so how do they watch it?
Yeah, maybe they just wanted to sell it.
It's a status symbol.
Yes.
So you're confirming that it's a working class icon.
Yes.
Or are you saying it's like a program to get a free TV?
Yeah, like, you know, the average yuppie, there's lots of people emailing, they subscribe to a bunch of lists and everything. The working class person in Mexico is not going to have many people emailing them. So they just might be texting their friend. So scanning information is not what they're inclined to be interested in because they can't read that well. So they wouldn't have a cell phone. It's too busy, too active. But they all have cell phones, though, don't they? But I don't know what they're using. They're not doing it in search mode.
They're not doing apps.
Yeah, they're just doing the practical texting your kid and that, but their main activity is in the big TV screen.
I wanted to sort of bring back that topic of the macula, the center vision and the periphery, and how the periphery will overtake something that becomes static in the central vision.
Yeah, the periphery will merge with the center, is that what you mean?
Will become emphasized as a result of maybe the center becoming static.
or enhance. Color TV or enhances the center. But he did say something like that. She read something where they get mixed up or they mix or something. You can have one with the other, but in another case, you can only have one. I don't know which it was.
Right. You can have the center, and that can be emphasized, and you can have that with the periphery, but you cannot have the periphery without the center, I think,
yeah.
Or without the macula.
Yeah. So, Bert, I figure he read that in some eye book.
He said,
yeah.
Peripheral vision can exist by itself.
So what can't exist by itself? Macula?
He says when the macula is involved, it is inevitable that the periphery be involved as well. Yeah, the macula needs the periphery, but the periphery
doesn't
can be
macula
on its own. Yeah.
And the metaphor there, the periphery is movement and more like visual space, you know, the independent individual. During Gutenberg conditions, the individual could be a separate man of talent, was the phrase, and be mobile and go from town to town and get a separate job and not be tribally loyal. So movement goes with the visual space, so that's the periphery. But the iconic tribal space of the macula, it can't be roaming separate. It is inclusive and therefore stays put.
It's almost like that's the visual bias that becomes static and needs to be obsolesced or upgraded.
Yeah, because none of what we're saying applies to the nomadic tribes and the horses over the Asian steppes or just traveling cavemen. They don't have a visual space framework. This is within visual space, this macular periphery dynamic.
I was also thinking of the anomalies that you can view with your eyes. The relaxed periphery is where you can begin to see those, and they move to the fore.
Yeah, you can begin to see what? The relaxed peripheries?
You can begin to see anomalies out of the periphery of your vision.
That's where Ian says that's how you see ghosts. You get in front of a mirror and look through your periphery and watch the mirror.
Well, there's an effect called hypnagogic, too, and it's just a neurological effect that can occur right before falling asleep. Or in case
of the
hypnagogic.
Yeah, hypnagogic.
Right, but that's basically what it could be explained as, or explained away as.
By what?
By macula activity? Seeing the anomalies, you could say that it's a neurological hallucination.
But what's that got to do with the macula?
Or it could be ghosts.
Oh, you're talking about the ghost point, not the macula.
I'm saying there's a logical effect, a reason for both of those things, for their being.
Well, scientists come up with a reason.
Right, you could think you saw ghosts, or you could pull something past someone in certain ways.
Yeah, it's neurologic agitation.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scientific description, but then there's Ion's version, which is that you aren't allowing those things to be front and center in your vision. You've made a rule about it.
Yeah.
But if you start to relax, it will move from the periphery to the fore of your vision. So you're looking right at them eventually.
It's like the ghost is in the interval between your periphery, eyeball periphery, and the wall, which has a mirror on it. The space in between the periphery and the wall is where the ghost is, the tactile space. I see a lot of that, he told us. Yeah, you'll see a lot of, you're sure you just saw someone walk in the room, and you look and there's nobody there. But I get that a lot because we got a lot of ghosts here.